Can you hear me?
Awesome. Ready? My name's Adam, and I'm participating in readings from the cell block today. I'm walking over to the Champaign County Courthouse on Main Street in Urbana, and part of the reason that this is really special to me is because prisoners in the United States and across the world are usually invisible to people who may live across the street in the same city, in the same county as them, and they're invisible and their voice is silent. It's really important that today, in front of a landmark such as the courthouse, that we make those prisoners in the United States a little bit more visible and their voices heard. I'm going to be reading passages by and about prisoners and prisons, and maybe talking to a few people that are coming in of the Champaign County Courthouse. Stared at by everybody inside the courthouse. A little bit unnerving, but we'll continue. The first reading that I'm going to do is about the Missouri Prisoners Labor Union. Just by and about prisoners and prisons, and maybe talking to a few people that are coming in of the Champaign County Courthouse. Okay. I'm getting stared at by everybody inside the courthouse. A little bit unnerving, but we'll continue. The first reading that I'm going to do is about the Missouri Prisoners Labor Union. And here's a little bit of information. This is actually from an appeal for support for the MPLU. The Missouri Prisoners Labor Union was organized by prisoners and supporters in the hope of bettering the living and working conditions in the state of Missouri prison system. One of our goals is to establish minimum wages for all prisoners in Missouri and at large, and to put a stop to all prisoner abuse. We were lawfully given recognition by the Secretary of State of Missouri on August 3rd of 1998. And since our arrival on the scene, members have been subjected to all forms of abuse and harassment by the Missouri Department of Corrections and the prison officials of Potosi Correctional Center, Jefferson City Correctional Center, Crossroads Correctional Center, and South Central Correctional Center. The MPLU is an organization that fights against oppression, repression, torture, brutality, rape, corruption, and exploitation of prisoners, both male and female. In this struggle, we seek to regain our human dignity. We seek to remove legislation which acts as a barrier to prisoners' right to vote. We seek to procure the minimum wage pay scale for all prisoners, to abolish all abuses of prisoners throughout the United States and around the world. And here's our mission statement. Human rights is the basis of freedom for all humans and requisite for peace in the world. The MPLU recognizes and believes in people having the right to govern their own lives and be freed from wage slavery. The MPLU recognizes and is founded upon the principle of liberty, equality, and solidarity, and that such principles are fortified with mutual aid, free association, and free cooperation. cooperation. The MPLU recognizes and strongly supports the abolition of all prisons everywhere, the abolition of the death penalty, and the ending of the capitalist system with its false democracy. We are seeking to form outside support groups on a local and national basis in order to ensure civil and human rights for all people. These groups could be involved in like work. Organizing a committee on behalf of prisoners framed for all alleged crime through the capitalist court for their political and social beliefs on prison organizing. Finding out about prison conditions by going into prisons, visiting the prisoners, investigating our complaints, questioning the officials, and monitoring the prison for violation of prisoner rights. Linking the people struggle associated with poverty, homelessness, hunger, racism, racial cultural profiling, drugs, and many other issues. Exposing the capitalist system of cops, laws, and prisons. Educating the community, prisoners, and others about how to fight against the legal system when justice is not served. Organizing and participating in movements for poor people's, prisoners' rights groups, women's rights groups, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender groups, left-wing groups, churches, and other groups that are involved in the struggle of the people for social change. Assisting prisoners in getting probation, parole, or pardons when they become eligible. Working against the death penalty to expose it as an instrument of genocide and political repression. The MPLU encourages a diversity of tactics as suggested here that could be delivered to help build unity around the country from state to state and from city to city. The MPLU's foremost intentions are to accomplish the goals above with the many autonomous groups that are doing the day-to-day grassroots activities. What unites us is our principled struggle to remove oppression, expose injustice and corruption, support political prisoners, and to provide advice and support to activists who put their bodies on the line in defense of freedom and the struggle for human rights for the people. There are a few prisoner support groups in Illinois. There aren't very many. The Anarchist Black Cross is basically run by a really great guy, Anthony, who puts out a lot of newsletters and has a zine distro that uses the writings and artwork of a lot of prisoners from around the state. And he does this because he wants to make those voices audible to the people who need to hear them. So this is another newsletter. It's the newsletter of the MPLU. It's called Off the Hook. And this is entitled Texas Prisoners Get Organized. The Missouri Prison Labor Union was organized by prisoners and supporters in the hope of bettering the living and working conditions in the state of Missouri prison system. One of our goals is to establish minimum wages for all prisons in Missouri and to stop all prison abuse. We were lawfully given recognition by the Secretary of State of Missouri on August 3rd, 1998, and since our arrival on the scene, members have been subjected to all forms of abuse and harassment by Missouri Department of Corrections. The MPLU is an organization that fights against oppression, repression, torture, brutality, and exploitation of prisoners, both male and female. In this struggle, we seek to regain our human dignity. We will seek to remove legislation which acts as a barrier to prisoners' right to vote. We'll work to procure the minimum wage pay scale for all prisoners, to abolish all abuses of prisoners throughout the United States and around the world. And those words, again, are taken from the mission statement of the MPLU. The MPLU is an anarchist-driven prison initiative that strikes at the core of slave labor capitalism. Prisoners are openly considered slaves by the very Constitutional Amendment 13 that supposedly abolished slavery. Prisoners can be forced to labor without pay, health care, or safety protections. Jerome White Bay, Bruce Cummings, Sheikh M. Moore, and others are horrifically oppressed, locked down in the hole, assaulted, and otherwise abused for their uncommonly courageous work in an unabashed effort to break them. This is why I have chosen not only to support them, but to establish the MPLU Texas local chapter so that Texas prisoners may strive and accomplish those same goals. When modern man looks at the problem of slavery with his 20th century background and in the light of the hideous crimes perpetrated during the slave trade and the abominable, barbarous treatment that was meted out to slaves, he discovers it as a most shocking and horrid crime. He is at loss and finds it extremely difficult to understand as to how such a thing can be approved of by a nation that considers itself to be based on equality and justice. Slavery has been and still is a melee of treachery, surmise, and violence of one nation or group of people to another due to its expansionist designs and the lust for exploitation in order to advance its own selfish ends. Such practices are and have been the outcome of personal ambition, pride, vanity, or a wish for vengeance. It was because of these inclinations that their consciences never twinged them when murdering, punishing, raping, or making their slaves perform loathsome and burdening jobs. The Hindus believed that the slaves, sudras, had sprung from the feet of the Creator, and hence they assumed that they were innately mean and low, a fate they could never contend or change. Therefore, the only way open before them was to suffer humiliation and chastisement patiently in their hope that their souls may alter their death, transmigrate into a better creation. They proceeded further to deprive them of even the will to rise in revolt against the unjust social order that subjected them to humiliation and misery. This is identical to what has taken place and continues to take place here in America. But what is more shocking is that they use their perverted interpretations of biblical scriptures to justify their inhumane acts. We need not discuss Roman civilization, which is being re-inked in modern-day America and Europe. Although slavery was verbally outlawed, it is still a physical act being carried out on the nation's people. It has been hidden in their constitution under the cloak of the 13th Amendment. Slavery was outlawed only to be further carried out through prison slavery by that amendment, a fact which cannot be denied by those who profit from this slavery. Our captivity within itself should have been enough for their exploitation in this prison slave system, but it wasn't, so they proceeded on to prison slave labor, monopolized by corporate elite. To name a few of these slaveholders, CMT Blues, Mecca T-shirts, Lee Jeans, Revlon, Nordstrom, Starbucks, Motorola, IBM, and MCI. Some corporations that underwrite prison construction bonds are Dole, Colgate, Suave, Merrill Lynch, Prudential Insurance, Goldman Sachs, and Smith Barney Shearson. These are only a few reasons I have decided to help further the goals of the MPLU. We will do what we can to help inmates stop further exploitation of our labor and stop all inhumane atrocities that we are subject to by the prison slave system from their prison slave jobs. We seek to be adequately paid for our labor and not some 25 cents per hour while these corporations are making $15 plus for our labor. By being paid duly for our labor while in prison, we can help support our families and better their conditions by removing the burden of having to support us while in prison, which plunges them deeper into poverty. We are sent to prison for a crime we committed and to serve time, not to be exploited by some corporate elite. The Texas local chapter will diligently strive with Texas prisoners to legally achieve our goals. If you have any input, ideas, offer of assistance, donations, or would like to know more about the MPLU and or Texas local chapter of MPLU, contact Sidney Williams, number 563-001, 899-FM-632, Kennedy, Texas, 78119.
Sandra Otten, and this is a letter written on the 21st of April of this year from Kyle Otten, who is inmate number R19417. Dear Mama, while I'm still here in the county jail, obviously, they didn't send me to prison yet, which is cool since Cynthia said she might be able to cop a plea sometime this week, and I would like to see what happens with that before I went. But honestly, I know that I don't know what's best for me, especially in this situation. I'm just leaving it to God and going with the flow. So how are you today? I'm hoping good. It sounds like everything's going well in your life right now. I'm doing good so far today. We had some good donuts for breakfast, and I woke up in a mood. I tried meditating a little this morning, but I was... thinking to myself for a little while. I've been praying and meditating a lot lately. It's amazing how quickly it takes effect, the feeling of God being present, or just more love in my heart, and how it carries so much. I know that just like you said, I'm so far from who I want to be, and I could be years from now, but it's exciting to be on the path again. Let me stop. Okay. I've been thinking about what you said about me going to grandma's a lot lately. This is what I think now. I'm definitely taking your advice. I think that you have insight on the situation. I don't know grandma's codependency and such as well as you, so I've decided to take your advice, but I also think you're closed-minded in some areas concerning the situation also, just like you admitted being. I don't write that the small grudges you hold on to and how they would alter your perception of the situation. I've heard you say so many times to pray for God's will and make an honest decision with your heart, and you can't go wrong, and that's what I'm doing. So again, I'm leaving it to God and going with the flow. The sun dried up the water outside today, so they let us play a little. I remember the first time I made up. Legs and then behind my back, and I thought it was so cool. And then you bought me a rim for Christmas on Evergreen, and I practiced every day or almost. I remember when you played with me at Bliss Park, the day when I bought a basketball at Voigt Brothers Sporting Goods when I wanted to meet John Taylor. I went in to buy the ball and I picked it out with money you gave me, went up to the man at the counter to pay for it and told the man, "Did you know that I'm your son?" And then he told me he didn't have any sons and I must be mistaken. And then I told him I was a son he never met, and he still said I was wrong. Anyway, it wasn't John. It was an employee who was probably 60 years old. Well, after I bought the ball and you and I went to the park to shoot around, I had a lot of fun. You took me to the park a lot, remember? Your favorite park was Evergreen with all the trails for walking where the new pool is, and I always liked Community Park with the two big slides. When we would go to the park, you would take me to McDonald's and I would always get a cheeseburger. Once I told you I loved cheeseburgers but couldn't eat hamburger, and then you explained to me that a cheeseburger was a hamburger with cheese on it. I remember all the underdogs you used to give me on the swings. Do you remember all the times you took me to the park? Well, When I do leave here to go to prison, could you do me a favor? Come and pick up all my clothes and letters. I'm not sure on how much time they give your family to come pick it up, but I would hate to have it all thrown away. I'll make sure to remind you again once I leave. Do you know the guy who does the show called Needle Drops on 90.1? His name is DJ Bozak. Anyway, if you do, or if you could ever introduce me to him, I would be much obliged. He has so much music I would love to get my hands on, but I have no clue where to find it, or don't even have the slightest idea where to start. He plays a lot of positive hip-hop, or what's called conscious hip-hop. I love hip-hop, but I can't listen to the commercialized garbage anymore. So if you ever get a chance to talk to him, could you help me out? Anyway, I'll talk to you soon. Love you. Mucho grande. Lotso big buncho. Kyle.
Thank you, Sandra. While you were reading that, we were approached by an officer and talked to Sarah for a second. So I just want to find out what the officer said.
He said, "What are we doing today?" And I said, "Well, I'm taking pictures of my friends." And he said, "Oh, what are they doing?" I said, "They're reading prisoners' writings." He said, "Oh." He turned around and walked away. I'm actually surprised that he didn't ask us to leave, because I've heard a lot of things about people getting, like this being one of the only public squares in Urbana, and people getting not permitted to hang out here, even though it has like things to sit on and it's an open space. We're all old enough, I guess. We're not a threat.
So, that was pretty moving.
Thank you. Yeah.
And I see you have a whole shoebox full.
Oh, I do. I have a big collection. Kyle was in the Department of Corrections all last year, and then he got out in November. And he had no rehabilitation while he was in there. He had no, he's a drug addict, and he had no rehabilitation. And he tried to get in a treatment center when he got out, but they had no beds available. So he started using, and things went downhill pretty quick. And then he tried again to get in a treatment center. He was on four different waiting lists. He could only get an appointment, like, in the next month, as all the appointments were a month out. And also, just to say, he's on parole, but there was no follow-up with the parole at all. So although they tell you you're on parole, they never help you find a job. They don't help you in any way. You just have to call in once a week. That's it. If you call in, you're fine. If you don't, but if you get arrested, then your parole's violated. So anyway, somewhere right around here, one night, he was living homeless. Actually, he stopped a guy on the street who was getting into a car. It was early in the morning, like 5 o'clock in the morning. They were both out. They were both intoxicated. And the cop came along. The other guy said, Kyle stole $2 from him. So the cop arrested Kyle for robbery. And so he got his parole violated and he went back to jail. And right now that charge is pending. As he said in the letter, it didn't get settled, but he had to go back to prison for the parole violation. But he spent some time in the jail here, but they are too full. The jail is completely...
Which jail is that?
The satellite jail and the downtown jail here is completely full to the brim. So anybody who is... got a parole violation, they sent him back to the Department of Corrections, even though they don't have their case settled here yet. So he's got this $2 charge for robbery that is... I try to look at it just as that it was an intervention. The cops probably knew he was living homeless. They knew he needed some help and that he could have done something a lot worse. So, you know, but why they didn't just charge him with a misdemeanor then to get him, you know, the parole violation, taking, you know, that he would have got his parole revoked, and that doesn't make sense. But anyway, so that's a little bit of the story of Kyle. But he's in Pinckneyville right now. He just went through what they call reception at Statesville. That's where you go when you first get back in the system or in the system, and then you get assigned to prison, which he's in Pinckneyville, which is a medium security prison. Down in the southern part of the state, which is where most of the prisons are in the state of Illinois, is in southern Illinois.
How far away is Pinckneyville from here?
I think it's about 2 hours. He was in Vienna all last year, which is 3.5 hours away from here, which is a real, real hardship for the most of the population of the state. It's, of course, in Chicago. A lot of the inmates are from Chicago. So there's a huge problem with visitation, which I have to say is better than some states that actually have privatized the prisons to the point where, you know, Texas actually houses private prisons where, for instance, Virginia didn't build any more prisons. Instead, Virginia's prisoners go to Texas to a private prison. And so you can imagine the visitation problems for the people who's in states where they actually ship them out of state. So, but it is bad here too. And just also to say, the visitation here at the county jail is atrocious. They have very few visiting hours. You get 20 minutes maximum twice a week that has to be divided between whoever comes to see the kid, to see the person in jail, the inmate. And you have to wait in line for hours. You have to be there hours early in order to get in line so that you can be assured a visit, because the maximum number of visitors they allow is 50 visitors. It makes no sense whatsoever. They cut it off at 50 visitors, even if they still have time left, and even if all the visitors haven't had any other visits or anything. So just this arbitrary number, 50 visitors is the max. And just the one little more gripe about that. So even if four people are seeing one person, that those four people all count as 50 visitors, even though they split a 20-minute visit between one inmate. The sheriff has set this rule. He's a new last year, and we don't know why he's done it, but I intend to find out. But so far, I don't know. So anyway.
hear more about Illinois prisons and your son over the next hour or two. I have a zine here called Reflections on Women in Prison, and it was edited by Summer Thomas and Jen Bowman. And there's a piece in here which is an interview with Ida McCrae Robinson and Christos. And so I thought that the three of us could take a person. I'll be Jen.
Okay.
And Christina over here will be Ida. And Sandra, you can be Christos.
Okay.
It's a three-parter.
Oh,
you can do it, Sarah.
Do you want to do it?
Okay.
Sarah's Christos. So this is a conversation with Ida McCrae Robinson and Christos. For those of you who are not familiar with these women, here's some information. Christos is a Native American lesbian poet who has written about 8 or 10 books of awesome poetry. She's an avid Native rights and prison activist. Ida is an ex-political prisoner who now has an organization called Families with a Future, based in the Bay Area. The organization tries to help children whose parents are incarcerated visit them in prison. If you want more information, Families with the Future, information will be on our resources page along with the list of Christos's poetry, and I'll give you that site later. This interview conversation took place over a very animated, fun afternoon at a local restaurant in Olympia. We talked about a lot of stuff, including women in prison. I really wanted to get the opportunity to have a conversation with these two women who, because they're women of color, their voices are rarely heard. The conversation moves around a lot, so please bear with us. It's still interesting. Just a couple of notes. When Christos talks about working in prison, she's talking about working in FCI Dublin, a women's prison in California. She does not work at Purdy in the state of Washington.
The women who come to prison from Wisconsin, honey, they are carrying so much time because we have some PCs there.
What's that?
Women who are there for protective custody with the feds because they either have a co-defendancy in the regular state prison or they snitch on somebody, whatever. I don't know, so they just have lots and lots of time.
So I kind of just want to talk about prisons. Last night, I guess, when you said that thing about it, about working in prisons, being spiritual, they really hit me hard. I don't know in what way it's spiritual for me going to prisons, but it's changed my life, and I can't really describe it because it's hard to describe those sort of things.
What I think of prison work as is, first of all, it's a way to keep your ego in check. In this society we live in a really perverse society, which includes and encourages everyone to have as big an ego as possible and to be as overwhelming to people as possible and to be really disgusting, right? So when you go into prison, the very experience of the physical construct of prison immediately reduces your ego because they have the keys, they have the power, and you have nothing. Even if you're not a prisoner, you're immediately reduced.
I think about that all the time. I pretty much don't have anything when I go in there at all. So you talked about smiling, putting on this facade.
That's interesting. That's not a question I think of, and I'll tell you why. We grew up in a time where you had to get involved in some type of struggle, and it was just not a question.
Right, and it was just mostly picking your struggle.
Right, so that's why it's an interesting question.
I know that my experience in mental hospitals was so traumatic that I can't do work about mental hospital stuff. I just can't. It just drives me nuts. I get scared. Prison was just like a sister to mental hospitals. I mean, in my opinion, they actually are sisters, right? Or brothers, or whatever the hell you want to call it. They're connected to each other because the ultimate thing is that women are controlled in our society by the issue of whether or not they are a good woman or a bad woman. There's various ways to punish what are so-called bad women. From a very young age, I was a bad woman, right? Actually, when I was really little, I was passive, very withdrawn because I was being beaten and all that kind of stuff. I was very quiet and always trying to do the right thing. When I got sexually abused, starting when I was 11, as often happens with young girls, I became very acting out, you know, I started stealing. I started beating boys up, just as you know I was wild. You could not control me, and I've never stopped being that way. The issue of being violated in that way, like that over a long period of time, my uncle violated me for 10 years. When I finally could get out of that situation, I was pretty gone. I didn't have much. There wasn't very many people in my life as a young girl who cared about whether I lived or died, quite frankly. And that's true for most Indian girls, right? So I was always politically active after that point, as well as in trouble.
Hi. It's like when I was 13, when I first marched against segregated schools in San Francisco. When I tell people that they're shocked. They say they weren't so segregated schools in San Francisco. And I'm like, there's still segregated schools in San Francisco.
Who thinks that?
Well...
We're a bunch of graduate students who can't read.
We're not neater. It's hard.
Yeah. And it's also the end of the semester. Well, that's the whole thing. There's the facade that segregation and racism ended when the civil rights movement happened.
Who thinks that?
I think a lot of people think that. I think a lot of white people think that.
Because it's convenient for them to do that.
Exactly.
Because that way they don't have to think about anything else or their racism. So it's another denial, some cop-out thing.
The other part of all that is that the good girl, bad girl thing is, if you've been comfortable when you grew up, not necessarily financially comfortable, but that nobody has really bothered you, you know? You haven't been challenged. You have an addiction to being comfortable. And therefore, you do not want to deal with class, race, politics, or anything, because you would much rather continue being comfortable. It's an addiction to being comfortable. If you're like me, and you've never had comfort for a moment in your life, you have no interest in comfort. When I get into a situation where, for instance, when I went to Yale University, it was a scream.
What did you do there?
I spoke. I did a reading. They had this huge Yale library, and all of these professors came up to me and shook my hand. What was really funny was that I was in a bad mood that day when I had had this woman do this racist thing to me on the plane, and I got up and read nothing but mad stuff. It was like bam, 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 one thing after the other. I didn't read any pretty stuff, no love poetry, nothing. The president comes up to me afterwards, and this is literally what he does. He takes my hand, and he's got this limp, dead fish handshake, and he says, "Thank you for this very nice evening." I was like, "Were you here, honey?" Afterwards, I had this big reception, and since I don't drink, I'm always going to these receptions and being the only sober person in the whole place, which is really depressing, you know? They're drinking and eating their wine and cheeses, and I'm just sort of standing there and blabbering on and just trying to be polite, you know, and I'm sober. They put me in one of those hotels with the ankle-breaking carpet and a little posh, and there's a little mint on the pillow. There's a bathrobe in there that I could use. It was deep, you know? They had room service. I could order anything I wanted to eat. So this is an experience where I'm supposed to feel comfortable because I'm having all my material needs met. And they're giving me this money and blah, blah, blah. I was profoundly uncomfortable. I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. When is someone going to burst through the door and say, "Okay, bitch, out with you"? I don't know how to be comfortable. I think that what happened is that someone took me to a powwow. I got involved with a defense group for Norma Jean Crow, and that's how I met Bo, my boyfriend, my girlfriend. No, wait. I remember how it happened. Somebody, I don't remember who, called me up and asked me to perform for Sparks Fly to raise money for the prisoners. So I went there and performed to raise money for the prisoners, and that's how it got started.
How long ago was that?
7 years ago, I guess. The first way I came into it was being a cultural worker raising money. Then I became very interested in the whole issue. I got active on the Norma Jean Crowe committee that was working for her release, which we managed to do. I think that at some point someone said to me, "Would you like to go out to the prison and meet the women?" And I said, "Yes." Actually, the women who were organizing it were expecting me to meet Linda Evans. That was the idea, is that I was going to meet Linda Evans and the other political prisoners. Linda is a very interesting person in that she understood that I was Native. She went immediately to the Four Winds Club and said, "This woman is coming. Would you like to come?" Linda was responsible for hooking me up with the Four Winds Club in the beginning, and she actually has been very respectful. She tends to come to our things and fade out. She's someone that sincerely tries to grasp what racism is and how it destroys people, and she's working to undo that. She's learned Spanish and so on, and she helps some of the Spanish-speaking women do translation. She's doing her best in the circumstances. So there I met the women in the Four Winds Club, and I fell in love, and that falling in love was a kind of recognition that if my own life had taken a little different turn here or there, that I could be in FCI Dublin, a women's prison in California. I still feel that to this day, that because I was a drug dealer when I was a young woman, and it just so happens that when they busted everyone else, I was in Big Sur.
Hi.
on holiday, and I didn't get caught. I felt a profound recognition that I could be there. The other thing that I felt was that these were indigenous women who had the most traumatic situation, the least resources. These were the people that nobody cared about. Really, literally, no one cared about. There was no defense committee fund for them. There were no lawyers. No one cared if they the rest of their lives. They were far from their families. They had no money. They had no visits. And the way that my father raised me was that always to be aware of those that have less than you, and that's your responsibility, to help to try and take care of those who have less than you. There was just a bond there. The fact that when they wouldn't let me in prison this last time, my heart was broken. I was hysterically crying and upset, and the woman called me. They used their prison commissary, tiny funds, to call me, and they were consoling me because I couldn't come in to see them. That was just so deep for me.
And we'll continue this conversation in a few minutes. Now on to Sandra.
Okay, I have another letter here. This one is from an inmate whose name is Michael. I didn't hit any. Is it still going good?
Yeah.
Okay. Michael's Selly first went to prison last year, and we've been corresponding since about a year, about since April of last year. And we are very good friends, as you'll find from this letter. Sandra, hey, young lady, I'm forcing myself to write this letter. He calls me young lady, but he's actually 34 and I'm 43. So now don't go thinking or feeling that I mean to have to force myself to write, think, spend time with you, because you are nearly always on my mind at all times. I mean, I'm forcing myself to sit still long enough to at least put something that is yours of me on paper to you. I enjoyed our call Friday and look forward to Wednesday. Your voice sounds much different on the phone. Don't ever apply as a phone sex operator. And he has a little smiley face. I don't know what he means by that. I'm sorry I've been so dark and distant here of late. I know you care and understand, but knowing you do doesn't make me feel any better about my lack of time and effort toward this friendship. I do so very much love you, care about you, and respect you. You are a huge part of my thought each and every day, Sandra. You are a reason for me to do right and keep my anger, frustration in check when situations arise in here that I otherwise wouldn't. When I'm tired and defeated with myself and my present situation, I escape in my mind to hopes and daydreams of some tomorrow where you and I sit at some lecture or share late evening coffee over conversation about a recently read book or are covered in sawdust from a framing project and a myriad of other scenarios. I can't believe how the changes around here are affecting me. I've always been the type that if walls were thrown up in front of me or pitfalls laid, I could fairly easily skirt them or cross them. These changes are different. They are cinching the noose a bit too tight. Money has never been a major issue to me. Between my prisoner savvy, my state pay for working, and being in the dietary, I made it okay. I could eat during the day, which afforded me certain things with my leftover state pay that I didn't.
Thank you.
He's given us his by every month, 2638, and then he doesn't include pens. It only includes the write-outs are letters with envelopes like this that have the mailing on it, so he can't do any extra writing to people. He says, pretty tight, huh? Plus, I don't go to chow on weekends because you never know when being paired up on the walk to chow or forgetting to take your cap off when you enter the dining room will cost you a ticket or a trip to SEG. And then he would lose his job and barely surviving. So what he's saying there is basically because he works in the cafeteria, he eats in the cafeteria, but on weekends when he doesn't work, he doesn't eat. He buys what he can from commissary, like ramen noodles or whatever, and cooks them in his hot pot because he doesn't want to take the chance to go to the through chow line because if he would get thrown in segregation, then he would lose his job and then he wouldn't have that money. So he just doesn't take a chance of doing it. And one of the other things to know is like segregation. They have so many beds that are for segregation. And if the prison is full, and the segregation beds are empty, well, guess what? They find violations to put people in segregation where they lose their job if they go. So it doesn't have to be any, it just has to be that the beds are empty. It's one of the things that scared me about Pinckneyville when I was reading on the website that that's where Kyle got assigned, was they have the biggest segregation unit of all, which means that they need to keep those beds full. That's how they do it. So. Well, really, like not taking your cap off when you walk into the dining hall could be a violation if they decided that, you know, this is the thing that they do in prison, and you know it even from being a visitor. They change the rules all the time. You're never on sure footing. Even going to be a visitor there one time, they'll, you know, like I've seen this happen, like a family shows up and with five kids and the 10-year-old doesn't have her Social Security card with her, and she's never had to have it before. And you know, and before they told them, oh, it was only, you know, like teenagers that had to have the Social Security card. Then all of a sudden, the 10-year-old doesn't have her Social Security card, so she can't get in to do visitation. There's nowhere for her to go. I've seen this happen. Like they're in Vienna, Illinois, this little hobunk town. They're from Chicago. They've driven 6 hours to get there, and they just have to turn around and go home. And they do it. I'm not kidding you. They just say, too bad. And so then it's magnified for the prisoners, but it's even just like that when you go to visit, just like they change the rules, and it's a power thing, you know, it's a power thing. So, but of course there's more serious things they're being in segregation for also. Most of the people in segregation are mentally ill, the ones who are there for long periods of time because they can't be with the general population because they're mentally ill and disruptive. They can't follow rules because they have. Kyle one time got sent there, and that was he had a panic attack when he was in prison, and he was working in the cafeteria, and he just he had never had a panic attack before, so he didn't know what was happening. Now, with talking about it and dissecting it, we attribute it to the fact that he had been on lockdown. The whole prison was, so they didn't have any yard. He's a basketball player. He needs to get his adrenaline moving, you know, he needs to have his serotonin moving, and he does that through exercise, and didn't have any of it for a long period of time. They were on lockdown for almost 3 weeks at that time, which when you're on lockdown, this is like, when you're on lockdown, you don't leave your cell. You have your meals delivered to you. You don't leave your cell, except for showers, twice a week. Showers twice a week is it, so. Anyway, so he had this panic attack where he just felt like the walls were closing in on him and he didn't know what to do. And he just kind of started screaming and realized like he was coming unglued. And so he laid down on the floor for a ride, he said, and then that didn't help. And he didn't know what to do. So he left the kitchen and went to his cell. And they arrested him for in-house escape was what they arrested him for. And, yeah,
that's so oxymoronic. In-house escape.
Uh-huh. By going to your own cell. I mean, they didn't, so they, you know, put out like an APB on him and found him in his cell and, arrested him, and he was still having the attack and he couldn't move. He was on the floor crying and he couldn't move. And then finally the officer is like, what is wrong with you, boy? And started yelling at him, and Kyle's like, I don't know. And And then they finally got him to a psychiatrist. So then the psychiatrist, but oh, before they did, when they arrested him, they actually had him in handcuffs and they're arresting him in the prison cell and going to take him to the segregation unit. And they told him right then and there, you're going to carry out your full sentence now because that's the consequence of an in-prison escape is that you have to carry out your full sentence and you don't get parole. And so all of a sudden he's in the middle of a and he's being told he's got to serve the whole 3 years instead of a year, and then which caused him more anxiety, of course. And so anyway, he did get to the shrink and they got it taken care of. But oh, when he left the shrink, he was still so disoriented that he couldn't find his way back to his cell, so they arrested him again. And it was just a nightmare.
Prisons. So I wonder what is going to a prison psychiatrist like? What is going to a prison doctor like? If you've had any conversations with Kyle or letters from Kyle about that?
Well, I have with Michael just about. I keep trying. He's the... side of Chicago and is really a pretty rough character, just in terms of he's spoken, but he doesn't it's just and stuff, and I tell just have interaction, even the medical is poor, but there is a get what they need. So anyway, there are little prison things I could do that are fairly minor in degree to make my life a little more comfortable, but that's not what I want to do or who I want to be. That is the exact life I'm rebuilding from. I'm sorry, I know that I'm just steadily ranting on. The whole Katie thing, the letter to Mom, the changes here, it's all mounted into this great beast that constantly looms above me, in my head, in my heart. When they're in the right place, I know that that which doesn't kill me only makes me stronger, and I will endure, and I will survive. But son of a bitch, Sandra, does the fucking trip have to have a few places along the damn way for a trooper? Thing are going
golf. I said, I guess I'm not a good pen pal. I have a pen pal that's also in prison, and I never send important. No, we both enjoy art, so I send him a lot of things and postcards with different artists and things like that, but no porn. I don't know.
Ever need to know the site.
Something. Okay.
So, something that Christina's going to read is some poetry from a zine called Prisoner Zines Workshop, and this is by Anthony Rayson, one of the prison activists here in Illinois. It's called The Voices Said.
Intrepidly, we fight to maintain our dignity and sanity in a place devoid of logic and humanity. As night approaches with loneliness, gloom, and despair spread their seeds, born in the ghetto of another man's land, while all roots have been severed to motherland. The voices said this will always be, for you are a prisoner, can't you see? We are herded like cattle across every state, for brothers and sisters command a premium rate. Forced to exist in a man-made hell, to the rest of the world, it's known as a cell. Subjected to atrocities, from which there is no protection, and if questioned, the oppressors claim no recollection. The voices said this will always be, for you are a prisoner, can't you see? Brothers and sisters adversely exploited each other, children today lacking respect for their mothers, in homes which are devoid of fathers, young brothers of today become tomorrow's robbers. In drug-saturated neighborhoods, sisters sell their kids and womanhood. The voices said there will always be, for you are a prisoner, can't you see? I think about Aphrodite, and I'm filled with rage, as Americana disapproves only on life stage. Famine-stricken Ethiopia overwhelms me with sadness. Watching what America wastes, I think that cruel madness. I think about the poor Latinos and Caucasians cast the same lot. Only now do we realize that all along, that's been a plot. The voices said there will always be, for we are prisoners, can't you see? By Akela de Terriche, June 13th, 1990.
Thank you very much.
All right. This is from May 16th, from Michael. Well, sleep came last night, but not before a fair amount of tossing and turning. I'm catching a bit of a cold. I feel it in my chest and throat. Felt it yesterday. I came in from work at 9 a.m. I wasn't feeling well and slept till about 1:30. I really only went into work to give Kyle the montage poetry book. I can't wait to see which one he likes. The coolest thing happened this morning. I get to work about 6 a.m., and the first thing I do is clean out and organize my stockroom. If it isn't too much of a mess, then I usually just sweep and mop it out real quick and go help Black or Jay, the two guys I work with that are really cool. Well, my room was fairly good to go, so I went up to help Black in the milk cooler. The cooler is always a mess because crates of milk leak onto the floor, so every day he has to move the crate stacks and the bleach mops in order to keep it from souring. Well, when I entered the cooler, he had already moved all the crate stacks so that the scattered puddles of milk were exposed for mopping. He hadn't started mopping yet and was still working on his huge daily cup of coffee. I don't know if he just dropped it or tried to set it down, and it fell all over. All I heard was the cup hit the floor, and Black exclaimed, "Damn it." Now remember, we're in the dietary, and all the floors have that perpetual slickness from the thin layer of grease oil on top of the tiles that never comes up entirely, no matter how much you mop. So here is three or four oddly shaped puddles of milk floating on a thin layer of grease, reaching till they are just stretched too thinly to reach any further in the great grooves between the four sink square clay tiles. And now a full cup of hot coffee hits the floor and splashes across the cold milk. Speak of any particular shapes or patterns the mixture took, it was constantly connecting in places, disconnecting in others, pooling in places, expanding in others. It seemed as if the white milk would stretch to the black coffee when it was near or vice versa, and as soon as it touched each stark, pure color, the white of the milk, the black of the coffee were instantly and permanently washed out into some varying degrees shades of caramel color. So now there are many colors and shapes. There's black, white, caramel shades, red from the tile, light brown, grout. I was mesmerized, standing there in the cold, cooler air. I wondered if life were so specifically designed and choreographed that the final position of this liquid collage had been programmed into each element long before the coffee ever began at the floor. perfect chaos, Sandra, but another altogether was about to be born of this accident. Here I was, fascinated by the spill, and mind you that there was a mess of milk on the floor to be cleaned. So why then, what then would propel me to grab the mop and haste to soak up the thoroughly intriguing spectacle? Reflex? Why would I rob myself of seeing its final shape, its final motion with the mop if I were so captivated? That I have cut off mid explain why. I could follow this thought deeper. A good relation so intrigued by the shapes existing and forming between us. And then it goes from my reflex, I snatch up the mop and instantly soak up what I had worked so hard. Instances in my life like this, enough to say that a pattern exists? I think so. Anyway, I just thought I'd share that with you. I'm putting a few more of my poems in here for you. I hope you're enjoying them. Which ones have I sent you, so I don't repeat? I just got done copying down the three pieces I'm sending. I can't believe the effect they still have on me. Your Kiss and Kelly Parks are both about Kelly. She pursued me when we were teenagers. We were so much. Her quest was different from mine and our time with I wrote about her because Marie. I don't something from me, then replace it with something themselves. So safe, Michael.
It's called It's Trial in Philadelphia Church. Prisoners, a civil jury acquitted the seven of Burke. It's proven that the prisoners no conspiracy proven by U.S. prosecutors. One prisoner who suffered from AIDS and the from horrific physical and psychological trauma he suffered in the beating has since died. Trial. Pinches were part of the writing crews that ripped it apart. Teen who were glad but is Camp Hell and to be coming to the state's largest and blackest prison. At Greaterford, whose massive, haunting walls seem to offer a raging, literal, and psychic and naked brutality, and terrorized by government officials sworn to protect, acting on nothing, assaulted over a dozen notions. Some, those few who could navigate the treacherous straits and shoals of civil sued state officials for damages. Others and blended into the while waiting for terms to expire so they could be free again. Several testified in the federal prosecution. One died. But all found out how fragile the very system that stole their very freedom was when the state committed crimes against them. All found out that words like justice, law, civil rights, and yes, crime have different and elastic meanings depending on whose rights were violated, who committed what crimes against whom, and whether one works for the system or against it. For those people, almost a million at last count, who wear the label prisoner around their necks, there is no law, there is no justice, there are no rights. This is written in February 1993, and since then, we've broken 2 million prisoners in the United States, way over that by now.
Okay. Of last year, it was got from him from prison. Mom, time since we've been in contact with each other, it feels real good to write you. I just got into population, my actual cell, about a half hour ago. I've been in receiving since I arrived here. I'm doing great, but I've been in a cell, locked up all day for a long time. Statesville was real bad. It was filthy, no running water, no toilet. I didn't take a crap for 4 days. I think I gained some weight, though. I'm in Shawnee. You probably know that from the internet. It's a medium max prison. They don't have any gateway program. I've been told that it takes 4 months before you can get into college classes, and the only way I'm going to get more good time is if I go for my GED again. I'm not sure if that's my smartest bet yet. I haven't met with any counselors yet. That's who I need to talk to about everything. Once I do, I will know a lot more. I talked to my cellie and two of his friends for a little while. He seems like a nice guy. His friend is the one who gave me the write-outs in the paper. Write-outs are the pre-stamped envelopes. In my wing, there's a whole bunch of people. Not sure how many, just a whole lot. I have to fill out a telephone list and a visitor's list. Then I get a PIN number before I can use the phone. It might take a while. The food here is good. That's a plus. I haven't seen a fight yet. I've been told they do happen, though. I really didn't know what actual prison is like yet. I got dressed out the other day. I got fresh clothes, all blue, khakis, and a jacket. I already put a huge cut inside my shoe. Toes stick out. The other day they let us go to gym and I tried to play basketball. That's when my foot ripped through the shoe. My old cellie got a write out. He gave his brother your number so he could call you and tell you about the money orders. You can't send orders larger than $50, but you could send one or more $50 orders. I really hate to ask you and Grandma for money, but I really do need it. Everything costs money. I don't have soap or anything right now. I could use all the money you guys could send. I thought that was funny. I won't get a TV or radio until I talk to you guys about it and the time I have to serve. But just to give you a clue, I would need at least $100 just to start with. Not need it, but for my own cooking, cleaning, shoes, socks, everything. I have to buy all that. Did you know they have to buy their own clothes in prison? Shoes, and the shoes are a real big deal because only buy the shoes that are for sale there, which are, they go through, you know, you get, I'm sure, like, they get a contract, like, the shoes and the shitty shoes, like, really, really, they charge $30 for a pair of tennis shoes, and then they don't last. I mean, they can't play basketball in them because Cusso Kyle would go, like, he couldn't except twice a week, so he didn't. Money orders, my number is 417, and when you sign the money order, make sure your signature is clear so they can read it.
Did you ever send them money?
Yeah. Yeah. They don't have any AA meetings here either that I know of. It would be a lot easier once I get my books. Right now, I can't wash clothes or anything. Tell everyone I'm doing good, and I'll write another letter as soon as I can. Call Karen for me if you could, and let her know I'm okay, and give her my address. Tell Grandma I love her and everyone else too. I love you, Mom. Love, Kyle.
Yes, I do, actually. And I came across this person after answering an ad in the Thrifty Nickel, and he was looking for a pen pal. And later on, I found out that his father had actually placed the ad for him. And what's funny is the way that I came about just corresponding with him is not only finding this ad in the Thrifty Nickel, but kind of this inner dialogue that happened with myself, the first time I'd ever spoken to someone who I recognized as being a prisoner or having been in prison was the first time I rode a Greyhound bus, which was just 2 years ago. And it's funny because I guess before when we were talking about, we were doing our play and we were talking about being someone of comfort. There are things in my life that haven't been of comfort, but one of the things that I've had is security in my life. And I didn't feel not secure around these people, but it was the first time I was ever confronted with anyone identifying themselves as a prisoner. These are two gentlemen who had just gotten out of prison, and they, you know, I went into the Greyhound station after being like, I don't know if I should take it. And they both started speaking to me, and at first the interaction was very flirtatious, and it was flirtatious and it was ridiculous at the same time. And then we got onto the bus, and I understood the thing that stood out for me in looking at them was, you know, guys are what they are, but the fact that they had all their belongings in just these cardboard boxes. And we got onto the bus, and one of them decided to sit by me. And as we rode into Chicago, you know, where his family was, he just revealed more and more information about himself to me. And it transcended that point of flirtation, and instead we started having a real conversation with one another. And he shared with me his drawings. He shared with me a lot of intimate details about his life and about just being in prison in general. He was in prison for 12 years, and he actually had gone back at another point. And it was amazing, because all of a sudden, he became so much more real when he said, I have a daughter that's your age, and I've never met her. And for me, that was just like, ugh, you know? I mean, the idea that all of a sudden I wasn't just a stranger, and the fact that he was revealing the fact that there were a lot of people probably in this world that, although he served his time, would still not give him the opportunity. It was just amazing, and it was nothing I ever had to really think about or deal with. And so, you know, this conversation moved me. It moved me more than a lot of the experiences that I've had in my life. And I think it's because I couldn't relate, but I wanted to so badly. And with that, I saw this ad in the Thrifty Nickel. And I explained to the person who was asking for a pen pal this experience. And I said, you know, I know that all prisoners aren't the same. And I felt asinine revealing this story. I mean, I was just like, I know that you're not this person. But I so wanted to experience something outside of what is my comfort level. I mean, I'm so based in university and so based in, like, oh, the comforts of, you know, my home. And the idea of writing someone who's supposed to be or deemed dangerous and revealing my address and, you know, revealing parts of myself, and really not the same way that you interact with someone around you, get something from them. You know, you don't get that sort of physical affection. You don't get that physical interaction. You don't get a lot of those other things when you're dealing with someone that's in prison. And that's how a lot of my relationships have been based. I mean, I'm able to see their smiling faces all the time, and we're able to share experiences and, you know, go places and share lunch or do whatever. And this is a relationship that's so much different. And the thing that's funny is we both have learned a lot from one another. As I mentioned before, we enjoy art, and we have a lot of art conversations. And, you know, he's explained to me his aspirations and what it is that he wants to do and what he does there. He spends a lot of his money on art supplies. I don't know. I've never asked about the soap. But I know that he enjoys painting, and I send him postcards of different painters, and we exchange letters. And I'm unable to send him any books. He doesn't have access to the internet. So it's a battle to figure out how I can get information in there, because some of the things I have sent aren't, he's unable to get and receive. And it's really frustrating just knowing that, you know, you're thinking about someone and you want them to have access to something and they cannot have it. And the state's not providing it for them either. And if they were, I would be fine with it. But the fact that there is no internet. I mean, I had this idea that prison, they're watching television every day. And, you know, in between that, they're looking at the internet and, you know. I mean, and I guess that's just based on movies. Or, you know, I mean, it's the same kind of idea or idealism in terms of welfare. And, you know, you don't, you're unaware of the fact that they're, in no way did I think prison became a privilege, but why would people want to keep on going back if it was so fucking bad? And and it's completely ignorant. I understand that. But, you know, you don't know until you have an interaction that involves that third party. And so anyway, we've been having a dialogue for a while, and it's proved, I think, beneficial for both of us. And it's a really eye-opening experience. And I don't know.
So what prison is he in?
He's actually in a prison in Ida.
Is that Western Illinois? Or?
I have no idea. It's
Big Muddy River. Is that what it is?
Big Muddy River. I don't know.
Big Muddy Correction Facility. Big Muddy. But that's not the same as Ina. There's one at about, well, this is one interesting thing. If you're in Terre Haute, Indiana, there's 100 prisons within 100 miles of Terre Haute. Yeah, it's amazing. So you don't know why he wasn't able to get the books that you sent him?
Well, I guess there was a whole entire list because after... I had sent something, and he received a notice that he wasn't able to receive it. He sent me this whole entire list of things that cannot be sent. And one of the things is that, for some reason, books cannot just be sent as is. And so,
see, that's interesting, too. Like, every prison in the Department of Corrections has their own rules, different rules. So some of them might be where you can't send hardback books. Some of them where the books have to be from the publisher instead of from you. So it's hard to negotiate it. I do want to tell a story about the Greyhound bus thing. That they used to put prisoners on the Amtrak to send them back home to Chicago, but the Amtrak has a lounge car, and where you can drink.
Yes.
And this is honestly, they had to change it because people would get drunk on the train and become unruly, and they would literally be met by the police and be arrested, and it would be a parole violation, and they would literally get off the train and go to Cook County Jail. And yes, and it happened over and over again. So they now put them on the Greyhound so that at least can, like, get them home. But, you know, just like this, you know, just like, I don't know. It just seemed like some kind of metaphor for something, like, that you couldn't even get, like, off the train.
One of the things I noticed when I was on the Greyhound, and I mean, this is my first time, so I was very much aware of everything going on. I'm like, oh, you know, and excited. And I noticed there was a difference in terms of treatment for the prisoners and then for the other passengers by the person, the driver. And he was very aware of the fact that this gentleman was talking to me. As I mentioned, he was definitely my senior. And he was talking to me, and the driver... He understood the fact that maybe I wouldn't feel comfortable with him sitting directly next to me, so he instead sat in front of... And he turned around and speak to me. And it was very interesting, that, like, treatment that happened without even really getting into the city. And, I thought that was really interesting.
Well, the thing that really moved me about your story was just that you're remembering that, you know, that you spent so much of your life not thinking about this whole population of people, not even being aware, and I did too. I mean, totally. I mean, I would think, when I would think about a prison, I would think, well, there's people there who need to be there, you know, basically. That's what you sort of think. I mean, then you know there's exceptions to it, but you just don't pay attention to it because you don't feel like they're part of the community. And that's what I like, want to just try to help always bring to the surface. Like, this is our community. Our community includes the people in prison, and the best way to do that is to know someone who somehow knows someone who knows someone in prison. I think just like about Kyle being in prison, and I am to people, I think it gives a whole segment of the population who thinks they don't know anybody in prison. Just when they think about prison now, they're going to have to remember, oh, yeah, Sandra's kid was in prison, and I know Sandra, and she's a like, decent person, you know? I mean, and so it's not a, it's so taboo.
It seems, though, that it seems that with all of the increase in the prison population, it's almost inevitable that really, just like some people think they don't know anyone who's gay, they you probably do. You're just not paying attention. If you
they're closeted.
Yeah.
But actually, they are closeted. It is absolutely true, because the more I speak about it and say, yeah, my son, he's in prison, then I'll have people like email me later or come up to me, you know, in private and say, oh, my son was in prison too, or my nephew did time, and you know, but people will never say, oh, yeah, like, yeah, I have a son in college, and I have, you know, I mean, you know, like, and, like, I do, I just like, yeah, I have a son in the Department of Corrections.
my parents have a friend, older couple, I think they're like 15 years old, so older than my parents, so they're probably almost like nearly 80 at this point. And they have a kid who's about maybe 10 years younger than my parents. And he's had just a really rough life, really rough road of it. And they write these Christmas letters, and they have about four kids. And they have this one child who is continually having difficulties. You know, he's been divorced, he's been to prison several times, he's had to declare bankruptcy, he's had, you know, pretty much everything. And they always address it, and they talk about it with no shame, and with the sense that they're not trying to brag in their letter about the accomplishments of their children. They are simply trying to explain where they are as a family and how and who these people are. And I actually enjoy reading their annual Christmas letter for that reason, because it is so honest, and it breaks down not only the scripted social expectations of that kind of form, but it really, I think, carves out a space for other people to be more honest and to really tell their stories.
Okay, well, I've got another one I'll read here. This is from Michael writing what he calls his Hey You letters, which are sort of journal entries. He writes this Hey You thing, I don't know, whatever. So, yes, that's right. It says, ready for a change of pace? Brace yourself now. I actually woke up in good spirits this morning. Don't ask me to explain how or why. I just feel as if the gloom and haze has been lifted. Don't get too excited. There's still an acute awareness of its presence lingering not too far away, but for the moment, I can think and breathe. Sitting with my back to the window in my cell, I can't see the beautiful day, but I can hear its splendor in the bird songs, and I can feel its promise warmly grazing the back of my neck. I wonder if the birds are chirping out some morning small talk about the weather or about their place for the day. 7 years and how many more? To you, it doesn't seem so far away this morning, at least not as distant as it does in the darkness. As distant as it does in the darkness. I'll read that paragraph over. 7 years and how many more? Till you, it doesn't seem so far away this morning, at least not as distant as it does in the darkness. If I close my eyes and just listen to and feel the morning through my window, I can almost lose this place. Letting myself imagine that opening my eyes would find me far away from here and now to a place that only lives in my thoughts. A quiet morning out in the country, a million things I need to be doing around the house, being temporarily discarded from my present contentment. Hey, you. Walking around our bright kitchen, humming some tune I know but can't name, barefoot in nothing but your nightshirt that doesn't quite cover your cute little rear, your hair still a tangle heap, he's not writing to me, all over your head, lost in your simple beauty, and thought strikes me, there never was before and never will be again another. Hey, you.
Thank you again. Thought maybe we could take a short break, stretch a little bit. I'm going to walk around the quote-unquote public square right in front of the courthouse and see if anybody will speak to us. So, and there's nobody. Of course, there are tons of people walking around. There are tons of people walking around until I want to speak to someone, and then it's deserted. So we're just going to take a break and wait until someone comes up here that'll speak to us.
Standing like directly in front of the door, but like a little bit more in front of it. or over, like, there's that little place that's like benches.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of like a public square there. I the guy who, the cop who came out and asked about the, what we were doing was really mainly concerned about the camera. It was clearly like
right.
anti-terrorism
right.
kind of thing.
Well, here's someone up here. Let me go okay. see if we'll talk. In the meantime, I'm going to talk about a Books to Prisoners project that we're starting here in Urbana-Champaign. And, well, let's see if this guy will talk to me. Excuse me, sir. I'm doing a project on people's views of prisons and the prison, the industrial prison industrial complex, and I want to see if you'll speak to me for a second. Sure. So you're here because you're going to court
For a domestic battery.
And so what's your view of the court system? What's your experience?
The laws are kind of screwed up because it seems like the woman always gets the, it's always, she's not guilty. Mm-hmm. In my case, I went to the police and I got arrested. Mm-hmm. I was all cut up, bruised up. She didn't have a mark on her. Mm-hmm. And, they need to so systematic, you know, mm-hmm. a little more open-minded.
Mm-hmm. Is this your first experience with the court system?
Yeah, other than traffic, yeah.
And so has it been, would you say it's been a negative experience?
Yeah, kind of. Like, court's supposed to be at 1:30. Last time I was here, it was like 2:30 before we even, you know, got started. What can I say? Sucks.
What do you expect will happen today?
Nothing. They'll call my name and I'll just plead not guilty and ask for a jury trial. That's what's supposed to happen today.
Okay. Well, good luck and we'll let you get to your trial.
Thank you.
Have a good day. I'm sorry? The hotel?
Yeah.
I don't know, but let me ask. Jumer Hotel? Looking for the Jumer Hotel? Let me ask you up here. Do you know where the Jumer Hotel is? I just got asked where the Jumer Hotel is. Do you know where the Jumer Hotel is?
Yeah, it's
is
that the really gaudy.
Is it the
okay. Neo Elizabethan?
Okay. If you take a right over here at the light, yeah. and then take your first right. You'll come up on Race, and it'll be on your left. It looks like a castle.
How many blocks?
It's about two blocks. That make a right over here, make your first right, and then it's two blocks that way. You can't miss it. So I gave directions to someone. I'm such a good citizen. No one would believe that I've been in jail before.
They told me what they did probably a month or two into us having like a written dialogue, and it really conflicted me because I had to confront the fact that like he did something that I completely did not agree with, honestly. And it was just like, whoa, it blew me away. And I understood the moral dilemma. I understood how education played a part in the decision that he made. I understood a lot of things. And it was really fucking hard. I mean, and it made me want to cry because it was just like, you get to know this person and you're like, wow, they're great. And you kind of want to almost be in a denial of like, oh, they're just at summer camp kind of thing. And then when he told me what happened, I completely understood why he was there. But I was so conflicted because he's actually in prison for beating someone, and they ended up dying. And this person was someone who was molesting children. And it was information that all of a sudden was put in front of him, and, you know, what happened, happened. And he wasn't the only one in the situation. It was perpetuated by someone else that was there. And, you know, he has not as much time as the other person. But still, it was amazing to actually have to deal with my own feelings about what was going on, because, you know, you hear stuff like that and you're like, I'm so like, no one deserves to die, you know, like, oh, everybody. And then all of a sudden it's put into practice and you're like, wow, I mean, what choice would I make? And I know what choice I would have made, but how, I mean, it's just so different when you actually hear it being applied. I mean, it's great to have theory and be like, oh, I know what I would do. I would immediately call the police and I would immediately do this. But when you're actually confronted with having to act or feeling like you have to act, that's something so different. And I mean, it was really conflicting. And we've talked about it. And, you know, he shared with me the information when he felt comfortable and he was okay with however I reacted. And, you know, I was very honest and said I didn't know what to say. You know, and that I explained to him like the 50 different ideas and thoughts I had and how they equate it really to nothing, because he made the choice that he made and I understand the choice that he made, because through what he explained to me, like through what I had access to.
An interesting thing that I find about prisoners' relationships is that they usually don't know what each other are in for. They don't talk about it. So it's not like you would think it would be like, oh yeah, he's the, you know, child molester down on row C or whatever. But for the most part, they do not know what each other are in for. They kind of don't want to, it seems like, because they know they would judge them or be judged by it. But it I don't know. I just find that, I found that really interesting that when I would ask Kyle, well, what's he in for? I don't know. You know, but one of the things that they that I'm sure comes into play with it is that it's very much a mind your own business. You've got to figure out how, like when we're in visiting, when you're in the Department of Corrections, you're in a great big room and you sit at sort of little cafeteria tables with four seats that are attached to the table, and the inmate has to sit in a certain one of the seats. And sometimes this is true and sometimes not. This is where they change the rules every time you go. Sometimes the inmate has to sit here. Sometimes it has to be there. Sometimes you have to all sit by the windows first. Sometimes you're never allowed to buy the windows. I've changed the rules every time. But first time I went to visit Kyle, he was very, like, he chastised me. Don't stop. Stop looking around. Don't look at the guard. You know, I mean, just like around kind of. Back, don't story. Then he said, like, one time he was eating and they have 10 minutes to eat start to finish, from the time they pick up their tray to the time they have to be back and in line. They have 10 minutes, and they do that for security reasons, because a lot of the problems happen during meal times and interaction like that. So this is the one rule. And Kyle says, whenever the 10-minute whistle blows, everybody just, you know, stuffs whatever food they have left on the plate in their mouth. And but you're not supposed to. The rule is you're not supposed to. You're supposed to stop eating immediately, get your tray back, and get in line. So the whistle blew, and he put a pear in his mouth. So he got a pear in his mouth, and he looked up and made eye contact with the guard at just then he got put in seg that time. For 2 days he was in seg for this incident of, and he's and really he thought it was, he had violated the rules. He had put the pear in his mouth after the bell rang, and that was not allowed. And normally it's done all the time, but he thinks it was because he made eye contact with the guy. The guy took it as a challenge, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Didn't you think it was interesting this week that one of the guards at the prison in Iraq, where all the atrocities have been, at the one that they interviewed, was a. This is what Dan Rather said, and we thought he would be most prepared for the situation because he was actually a prison guard as a civilian. And I'm thinking,
thinking, yeah. Yeah, he got his training well. He got his training well. Just the dehumanization of them. And some of them, you know, some of the guards are and some of them aren't. You know, down in southern Illinois, they're all white. They're all uneducated. That's for sure. I mean, there's like, it's pretty much almost stereotypical good old boy kind of, and then there's, you know, some women in it too, but it seems they know each other. I mean, the guards and prisoners know each other, you know, by more than number. They, if you've been there a while, they know your name. But some of them do seem to have relationships with them, but others are just, they don't treat them human. That's the way it is.
I have a question for you. I may have missed this earlier, but how did you get in touch with Michael?
Oh, he was Kyle's first cellmate. So he kind of, and we just felt so fortunate because I was, you know, so nervous for Kyle. And it's really hard to learn the ropes in prison. They do not give you a manual and say, okay, now this is how you get your laundry done. You make sure on Tuesday that you get da-da-da-da, you have the soap bought, you're getting in line, nothing like that. They don't give you any instructions for anything. You have to figure out how to do, like, you have to figure out how to apply for your GED. You know, I mean, counselors will meet with you every once in a while, but for the most part, you have to figure out even, like how to eat, you know what I mean? Like what's allowed, what isn't allowed, all that stuff. But anyway, so he had Michael for a cellmate, was one of his first cellmates. Michael was like, he said, I'll write anybody. He loves to write. Of course, he's a writer. I said, yeah, tell your mom I'll write her. And so for a while he wrote both me and my mother. My mother was corresponding with him too, but she was trying to save his soul. So he gave up on that one.
Well, I'm going to go see if I can talk to anybody else.
Okay.
Talk to one person besides the directions person. I'm doing a project, part of my friend's art project, and trying to get people's comments on prisons and courts and stuff like that. Would you be willing to be interviewed? It's any of your thoughts, anything that you feel. You know, actually, you know, general questions like, you know, how do you feel about the court system? Do you work here? Do you? Hold on, can you say it again? What do you think about the court system?
I think that is bullshit.
Why is that?
As far as how, I mean, I don't understand, like, why is it that? You're molesting kids is what, 5 to 10 years?
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is, that happened?
I don't know. I have no idea. Else I would try to do something about it.
Do you have a...
Yes.
What has your personal experience been with the court?
And I mean, I can admit and I can accept what I did and face up to what I have to, my responsibilities. Like, I don't think the 30 of probation. So. I told them as far as, like, the stuff that I did, which was forgery, it was committed with me and other people. But since I got caught with it, I'm taking, like, everything, you know what I'm saying, everything. And I don't
think the alternative could have been.
I mean, well, I feel like they should have looked more into it, and they didn't. You know, it's like.
The alternative could have been.
I mean, well, I feel like they should have looked more into it, and they didn't. You know, it's like you guilty to prove anything. That's what that's what I feel.
So, have you been?
And I got 30 months.
30. What is the process like of being on probation?
It's kind of hard. You gotta, it's in order to get a good job, so it's hard.
Like, come here once a week? Or?
You come here once a month. Well, it all depends on what type of probation you're on.
You have to come here once a month. Is there a certain time you have to come?
Certain times. You can pick, like, what days you want to come and what times, whatever. Good. That's about it. And you take drops. You know, actually, they do this, like, it's some new thing they got. This little eye thing. You look into this thing. Uh-huh. And they tell you, like, when you see a dot, say, like, right. Some bullshit, basically.
So I guess that it is bullshit.
Yeah. Okay.
Much for letting me interview you.
What's your name?
Adam.
Hi, Adam. Hi.
Nice to meet you. So there's another person who's been affected by the court system here in Urbana-Champaign. Getting back to the Books Through Bars, the Books to Prisoners program, there's a network of organizations around the country that are working on getting books to prisoners. And I think Sandra talked about this, and actually Christina talked about it also, is that it's really difficult for prisoners to receive books. A lot of different prisons have different restrictions, such as prisoners can from bookstores, some from publishers only, and so these organizations are sort of a response to that, trying to get books to prisoners by getting sponsors that are bookstores and getting sponsors that are publishers. So there's one that's starting up here in Urbana-Champaign, and if you want more information on the national network, go to www.booksthroughbars.org.
There's a whole philosophy they talked about at the prison abolitionist movement, that all programming in prison and all these incentives is just a way to keep people in line so they don't rebel and really face the atrocities of prison life and the absolute wrongness of imprisoning people. And so, yes, yeah. Let's put them, not even interested in, has nothing to do with it, so they can get an extra half a day off their sentence for every day that they're in and have this thing to hold over their head so that they don't demand, to be treated humanely, and that is let out of the goddamn prison system that they shouldn't be in to begin with. No, I have a big, it was interesting, the whole prison abolition, their tactic is to underfund prisons. I mean, that's what their tactic is, to not put money into the prison systems, but you know, first, you know, truth, that's the reality. Like, they don't cut salaries, you know, they don't build less prisons. They find another way to scrape 3 cents.
Yeah, you eat it for 10 cents a day.
That's right. It's exactly right. They cut the programming. You know, they do these things that that seem.
But it's got to get worse before it gets better.
I know. And like, well, yeah, but at whose expense? I don't know. It's hard. It's hard for me to complete. I would be behind the prison abolition movement if that wasn't the tactic that was required, so I don't
do
know.
Have another idea, like better, less harmful in the short term kind of tactics?
Well, I do think not building prisons would be a good idea, not building anymore. But then again, the thing I read from Kyle when he was in Statesville, where reception was, they It was just the pits. I mean, it's the oldest. It's a really old, old prison. And they literally did not have running water, you know. So, I mean, that's... they didn't. The 4 days he was there. Now, he was in Statesville again when he got put back in the system? No, you wouldn't think so. But they have a new... Well, actually, there's an association called the John Howard Association that does prison visits. It's an Illinois advocacy group, and they... anyway, June 11th for to tour it, because they do have a new prison reception center there now, which sure it'll make things easier then for the prisoners. But Kyle was just in it, and he said, "Oh no, we have running water," but so they had put him in a brand new place before it was ready. They had no electricity, so when it was dark, they were done. You know, they were done for the day because their little window had no light coming in it, and so they were done. But and in reception, you have no books, you have no writing material, you have nothing. So do not to be there very long. Although Kyle said there were some people a month in a place without electricity and no visiting, no, and you don't do anything except stay in your cell. You have no possessions. You can't buy anything from commissary. It's supposed to be a very thing until you get assigned your place. Yeah. And where you could decide, okay, this person that they have this solution. Then you could make it just in a certain way that these people get my distribution. It's supposed to be about keeping, right? So no rehabilitation built into it whatsoever, then all we're doing is aggravating the situation by making them angry and with the system that's unjust anyway, you know. So, like, you're pissing them off, you're treating them inhumanely, and...
kind of struggle. I mean, they become dependent upon the system because of the stigma that happens to prisoner when they then go out, and also just that sense of that environment of control that they're in for so incredibly long, the inability to make choices, the inability to even, I mean, do the things that are everyday function.
A lot of ways, you know.
And they don't prepare them also to come back into the world as it is now. I mean, with the gentleman that I met before, you know, it was like, oh, cell phones, people have cell phones, everybody has a cell phone. I mean, the fact that he was even questioning it was like, oh yeah, you know. I mean, you don't think about that kind of stuff, you know. I mean, we don't have beta VCRs anymore, and it's sad that they are unable. I don't really think that the system works for people to ever escape the system. It works just like all these other governmental systems that are, they're maintained, and it's checks and balances, and they want that kind of power, because then we have placement. Then we know where our stance is and our status.
Yeah, just if you get on the website and read the language, so when Kyle was just figuring out where he was getting assigned, I was reading it all the different facilities, and the warden writes what they're going to put on their website. And the warden at Pinckneyville was very proud of the fact that they have this new feed facility where I'm serious, that's what he called their cafeteria, was the feed facility. And that prisoner feeds can take place in 10 minutes, and they have this new wall up so that they can do two feeds at one time. And so, you know, just this just the...
Where did you find this?
It's on the Illinois Department of Corrections website. Under the Pinckneyville facility.
Yeah, you can, find different locations. You can find different locations, and you can... They each have a report on, you know, why their prison is great. And you can also, and a lot of people don't know this, find prisoners on there. If you have their name or their birth date or their prisoner number, you can find, you know, where they're located at because, you know, like Sandra said, they move around a lot.
Yeah, you can see their picture. You can know what their crimes are. You can see what their tattoos are. They have those listed there. what they were charged with. And how long their sentence is and when their expected parole is. And, but the facility one is interesting just to read because the warden writes it. So every one of them's got it. And some of them have a rehabilitative tone to it. You can tell that that's what they're stressing more. And when he was at Vienna, I could tell that they were stressing prisoner safety. That's what they were stressing. On the website. And when you got there, that you can tell that that is all that they're about there. There is no programming there. They do not care a hoot about programming. They do not have a writing class. They do not have an AA meeting. They don't, because they do their feeds in 10 minutes. You know, it's all this, that things that are stressed are things about prisoner safety. So it's
preventing violence.
So, and actually, to tell you the truth, it was a very safe facility. Kyle never felt, one time he had this incident on the basketball court where there was, you know, just a power play, and he stayed off the court for several days because he was afraid of the guy Good wouldn't stop confronting him. But for the most part, it was a really safe facility, and at the sacrifice of programming and freedom. It was safety at the sacrifice of freedom, which I just thought was interesting. Yeah, it is, isn't it? It is.
I had to go on the website this past week because we're starting the Urbana-Champaign Books to Prisoners project, and so I wanted to make sure that all the prisoners were where they belonged. And I thought, you know, hey, they've got the locations. Maybe they'll talk about, you know, how people can correspond with them. And they do give an address, an inmate address that you can send stuff to, but it has absolutely no information on what you can send to them. So I had to call like 20 prisons to find out what their restrictions on mail was. And so that was sort of frustrating that they have, you know, they don't sort of facilitate families writing to them or friends writing to them.
And they don't. There's an effort to create the illusion of openness and providing services while actually concealing the information that you'd actually need to do it.
They wouldn't be able to do that because they change the rules every friggin' week.
Well, and that's what's scary because the majority of the prisons that I talk to, and you're always told that, you know, most prisons only allow books from publishers or from bookstores, or they don't allow hardbacks. And I'd say out of 20, only one or two said that they only allowed books from publishers or bookstores. And that scares me because I don't think that's true. And I'm about to send off a whole bunch of packages, and you know, I'm afraid that they're all going to be, you know, shipped back, and that people
are
not going to get
them back. Because I haven't
actually. Actually, I think that the Illinois Department of Corrections mostly will accept books that aren't from publishers. Here at the county jail, they won't. At the county jail, they'll only accept books from publishers. And but the hardback, softback thing, did you find that that was an issue pretty much?
The majority of prisons only had restrictions as far as content. No certain types of penetration, certain types of pornography, anything about drugs, anything that would be a threat to the facility. And
a way to make weapons.
Weapons, bombs.
Any weapons broken down,
right.
Any kind of ways of making tools, anything that, I mean, there's like a whole entire list, and it seems like, well, shit, a paintbrush can then become this mass destructive weapon, and I mean, basically, the guidelines that I've received have been so incredibly open that almost anything that I send could then be like, no, you know, this can't go through because this is talking about this, or this has politics that speak on this, or any of that stuff. And it's very, very frustrating, very, very difficult. And I think that, honestly, the reason why my pen pal was seeking out other people to write to, and I was the only person that answered the ad, was specifically because of the frustration of his family to even have contact with him. I mean, every single thing has a guideline, and when you are a parent that has more than one child, to actually put forth the energy, I mean, as well as the expense, of trying to form some kind of communication, it's damn near impossible.
One of the things that I spoke to one of the prison mailrooms, and you know, they listed off all of the other things that we talked about, explosives, threats to the facility, pornography, and then so nonchalantly she said, oh, we also don't allow anything about homosexuality in there. And I was, I mean, the first thing that came to mind obviously was, okay, they want to stop prison rape, but I was just so like flabbergasted that they can so easily just, you know, say nothing about.
Oh, this is, it's very interesting that they actually, the term that most of the inmates use is sissies. That's the term that they use for gays. And they say that most of the sissies are in one facility. I can't remember which one it is right now, but they actually
separate them out.
Yes, yeah. They do. And
wait,
yeah.
I mean, is that one of the questions that they ask?
No.
No.
But they will, I think they, I don't know. I don't know.
About transgendered people?
No. No, they will actually separate out people that they say. And they can actually have partners. I have been told that they can have a cellmate that then is their partner. It's very, but they want to take them out of regular
population
because of the potential spread of disease and because of just the idea of, like, then all of a sudden everybody else will become gay, you know? I mean, it's like, oh, that's the way to go.
Well, interestingly, I mean, Michael is facing this right now. He's heterosexual, but he has a friend, Jay, who's bisexual in there, and it's his best friend. And then there's this new guy, Troy, who's just been around recently, and Troy's got a crush on Michael. And so he knows Michael's open to gays because his best friend's bisexual, right? So Troy is trying to seduce Michael, and he's been in prison a long time. And I mean, there's the whole thing. It's called gay for the stay, you know, and that people do. Yes, gay for the stay is one of the terms that they use. And yeah, you got to learn the lingo.
Yeah,
there's a whole deal.
I've heard living on like the down low, and then you know, oh, I'm only gay when I'm in prison, and then when I'm not, I'm, you know.
So, but he's like, he doesn't want to, he wants to live with integrity, so he doesn't want to turn to homosexuality just because he's in prison. But yet, here, he's this guy that's cute, that's seducing him, who's flattering him and touching him. He's giving him foot rubs, and, you know, all this stuff. I know, it's, I know. So they're not completely separated, but if you're talking about the idea about safety in prison, it is one of the things. So you give up freedom for safety again. Yes, we are. All about prisoners and prisons.
Do you have any thoughts on prisoners or prisons?
I don't want to go there.
You don't want to go to prison?
I'm trying to avoid it right now.
How's that going?
Do you have a lawyer? One that you paid for?
Yes. Right. And I hear he's a big shout around town.
Who is it?
Steve Beckett.
Good lawyer, I hear. So.
I read a book.
You read lots of books.
I know, I read lots of books, but I've read a book on applicable law.
Yeah.
Is this being
broadcast yet?
Is it?
It should be, except that the network from Cranard isn't very good, and it keeps shutting down. So, it broadcasts from time to time.
I showed my friend Leo this weekend. He wanted to do a radio show, like a 50s radio show, and tell him a story.
Where?
We were in poking through the MFA show, and he wanted to get out there. Because I told him it was broadcasting, and he was like, why, I started doing sound effects, and I was like...
Maybe, what time it is? I could send you the MP3 of it.
Really?
Yeah, it's a...
I don't know.
Was it Saturday, Sunday?
Saturday.
Saturday afternoon?
Between 3 and 6.
Yeah, I can try sending that to you.
I'm going to tell one more story, just a little one. Just in order for safety also, just to know, they also they separate by race so that they have, only blacks only have black cellmates, whites only have white cellmates, unless Latinos go either with whites or with blacks.
That is
fucked up, but they do it for safety reasons. They think it may... Not a big Asian population in the IDOC, but I'm sure there's some exceptions. But for the most part, I was so flabbergasted by that, and just like, and then maybe they don't do it at every prison. They did it at the one Kyle was in, and like I said, they are all about safety there. They don't give a shit about your civil rights. They don't give a shit. They're all about like safety. That's
they
it.
Do because of gangs and affiliations, and the idea of you being with someone who. An interracial, like, cellmate kind of thing. I mean, they don't know if someone then becomes Aryan or if someone... I mean, they do it for the safety, not only in terms of what?
I was just going to say, wouldn't it make sense, like, if you're with all white cellmates that you're more likely to become
part of it? They like the idea of also the segregation that happens in the courtyard, you know? I mean, the idea of then, like, they know that when they start to see black and white cellmates kind of integrating in that system, that then it's like, okay, something might be going on. And so it becomes this sort of protection, again, for the individual and for the whole entire population, because then they can keep track of who's with whom.
It's bullshit, but there you go.
I think that's the operative word of the day, because the woman over there, she's like, it's bullshit.
In response to what question?
Well, she was charged with forgery, and she's on probation for 30 months. And, and so she has to come once a month to the courthouse and, you know, meet with her probation officer or whatever. And she just thought the whole system was bullshit. She felt like she got, you know, an unfair deal and, you know, what have you. So, bullshit. So,
thank you very much.
Sign it off.
Okay, thank you.